This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. Last Thursday, the North Carolina Senate passed its version of the state budget. There were some winners: education, with Senate leaders putting in more money for low-wealth school districts than Governor Mike Easley had recommended. And also winners were corporations, which saw a proposed reduction in the tax rates. But other constituencies were not so lucky. If, for instance, you're a smoker who's on Medicaid, likes candy, plays video poker, and makes less than $200,000 per year, you may not like this budget. So how much of this version of the budget is going to make it through the final cuts? Here to help us understand all this are Jack Betts, who is an associate editor of the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back, Jack.
Good to be here. Thanks.
And Rob Christensen, political columnist at the Raleigh News and Observer. Welcome back, Rob.
Hey, Melinda.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. What do you like about the budget? What do you dislike? What changes would you want to see? It is, in the end, all about the money. Give us a call, 1-877-962-9862. Well, Jack Betts, you wrote in your column the other day that the state Senate had knitted together, and I'm using your words here, a ratty fabric of blunders. So, what's the biggest blunder you saw there?
Well, I think there were two key blunders that distract attention from some of the substantive things in the budget. One, in passing the budget, the Senate amended a lottery law and a lottery process that doesn't exist yet in North Carolina. And it reminded me a little bit of a few years ago. You may remember that Governor Easley put in his state budget proceeds from a lottery that did not exist yet. I guess the Senate couldn't stand the same temptation. And in doing so, it looks like a sneaky and cynical ploy to force the Senate's version of a lottery through the legislature. The House has passed a lottery.
A standalone bill.
A very different kind of lottery with very tight restrictions on advertising. And the Senate wants a much more aggressive advertising program. And the other mistake that I think the Senate made was in including a number of special provisions, which are items not necessarily related to the spending of money, which is what the budget is all about, but these are policy choices that have some financial implications, but policy choices that really ought to have been debated on their own merits in the House and Senate. Unfortunately, we see less and less of those debates on their own merits, and I think those are two of the things that make that fabric kind of ratty.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll get to some of those particulars in a moment, but it is, as you say, a case of putting it all in one big bill that the legislators, the senators, would either have to say A or nay to. There was no looking at one item and saying, I don't like that, and pulling it out of there, Rob.
Well, Melinda, it's an old legislative trick. You know, how do you get enough votes and together to pass what you need to pass? And the way you do that is you throw everything but the kitchen sink into the bill, which is what they did. And then you force your team, in this case the Democrats, which control the Senate, to vote for it. So it's really, you know, most experts would say this is not a pretty or a good government kind of way to do this, that if you're going to pass these big issues like, you know, banning video poker, like promoting a state lottery, like, you know, giving universities a chance to raise, like UNC and NC State, to raise tuitions, and all these are very important issues that ought to be debated on their own. And what happens as a way to kind of grease the skids and get the votes, they throw them all together. Now, this is not new. This has been done for many, many years. It's an old legislative trick, but this one seems to be particularly bad.
And there were no legislators among the Democrats. There was a lot of coverage of several Democrats who opposed the lottery, for instance, but did not vote against the budget bill just because the amendments to the lottery were in there.
Well, it's very interesting. It's a way, you know, there really is a lot of pressure on a Democrat to vote for the budget, because the budget is the single most important document that the General Assembly, you know, it's the philosophy of the body. It contains the goals of what their version of their vision of what the state should be. And so therefore, and it's put together by the leadership with a lot of input from members. So
Democratic leadership.
Democratic leadership, because it's a Democrat-controlled state senate. And so, therefore, there is an immense pressure. One of the legislators, Senator Ellie Kennard, who's from Carrboro, she voted against the budget a couple years ago when the Democratic proposed budget. And she says she's felt it ever since. Not that people were mean to her, but it labeled her as an outsider. So there were a lot of people who some of them were, for example, party liberals who didn't like some of the cuts in Medicaid and insurance for the poor and didn't like other aspects. There were those who were opposed to the state lottery. But in the end, they all voted for it, all the Democrats, that is, in the Senate voted for it, because there was this immense pressure. You know, the Senate's a very small little club. And if you step outside that club, you're going to isolate yourself as a backbencher.
And of course, then your chances of getting a bill that you really want passed down the road are slimmer.
Sure. And since the advent of the strong caucus system in the state Senate, where the Democratic caucus and the Republican caucus often decides what the proper stance will be, and every member is expected to vote that way, it just makes it even harder to step out. We saw a couple of votes on the budget bill in which two Democrats, Janet Cowell from Wake County and Dan Klodfelter from Mecklenburg County, who have reservations, strong reservations about a lottery, voted with the other side on a procedural vote to open up that particular issue, but it failed. Mm-hmm. In the end, it passed pretty much on party lines.
Melinda, you talk about the pressures on legislators. Not only does it mean, as you point out, whether it could affect whether they get their bill through and help out their county and their constituents, but being in good standing with leadership means what kind of committee chairmanship or committee assignments you're going to have, whether you're going to be put on an important committee or unimportant committee. And the way the political money is raised in the legislature these days is tremendous amounts of money are raised by the leadership of both the Senate and the House. So therefore, it could also mean a question whether you're going to get the cash that you need if you're in a tough reelection campaign, whether the leadership's going to send you $100,000 to beat back your opponent. So there are a lot of reasons to vote with your party's leadership.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're talking about the what's been going on in the state legislature. The big news, of course, last week was that the state Senate passed its first version of a budget, $17 billion budget, including in it some language about a lottery, even though the state Senate hasn't voted on a lottery per se, standing alone, but it was part of that bigger budget package. Other aspects of the budget, it called for raising the cigarette tax. I mean, mm-hmm. There was a time in North Carolina that would have been anathema. You just would not have raised the tax on a pack of cigarettes by 35 cents, up to 40 cents a pack now.
Right? Would have been unheard of. It was unheard of practically, in the previous three decades. I remember a day in the state Senate back in the 1980s when Senator Rachel Gray of High Point introduced a bill to raise the cigarette tax. I don't remember the amount, but it wasn't much. It might have been a nickel. And Senator R.C. Soles had the bill tabled on the spot. It didn't even get introduced and assigned to a committee. It was dead on arrival. And now the debate is over how big a cigarette tax increase. Some Senate leaders wanted just a quarter. The governor wanted 40 cents in the first year. Right now, the Senate bill stands at a 35-cent per pack mm-hmm. increase.
Well, the sounds you heard coming from Raleigh, Melinda, was the sacred cow crashing to the ground and splintering into a thousand different pieces. I mean, it is absolutely amazing. The governor, who is the son of a tobacco warehouseman from Rocky Mount, was among those proposing a cigarette tax increase. You know, it used to be that the legislature is one of the last smoke-filled areas in the whole state because they allowed no one even dared banning smoking from the floor, the committee room. There are murals in the legislative building, the glories of tobacco. But the fact of the matter is that tobacco simply, even though all the sports announcers say, here we are on Tobacco Road, well, actually, tobacco is just not that important anymore. That really is anachronism. And one of those little startling statistics, there are more people who work today at the IBM facility in the Research Triangle Park than grow tobacco in North Carolina. That's amazing.
And we can thank, well, the buyout most recently of the quotas, the allotments, I mean, had a role. That once that was done, then we could think about raising the tax, because the argument couldn't be brought forward about what about the poor tobacco farmer, because the tobacco farmers that are left are going to be larger,
exactly,
larger tobacco farmers in the state. So there were also taxes on candy, liquors, telephone service, and keeping in a sales tax that was implemented a few years ago. So we have all this money, and I'd like to talk about some of the things that it's going to go pay for. One of the things this would pay for would be state employees getting a small hike in their wages.
They're getting a small hike. Another thing that this pays for is a couple of key tax cuts, cutting the highest marginal income tax rate, I believe, by 0.25%, mm-hmm. cutting the corporate income tax rate, I believe, by 0.5%. North Carolina's overall state and local tax burden isn't particularly high nationally. It's in the moderate to low side range, but among southeastern states, our corporate and highest income tax rates were thought to be high, and Senate leaders, like everyone else in Raleigh, it seems to believe that the legislature needs to do something to preserve this pro-business atmosphere.
And we'll talk more about that, about the shifts in where money will come from in the state budget. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. Raising taxes on cigarette, candy, and liquor, lowering taxes on corporations and those in the higher tax income brackets. That's in the budget. We're talking with Jack Betts from the Charlotte Observer and Rob Christensen from the Raleigh News and Observer, and we'll have more in our conversation ahead. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. There will no doubt be debate this week in the North Carolina General Assembly over what the Senate did last week. It's proposed $17 billion budget. It now moves over to the House and will be dissected for some time. With us now today to understand what may or may not happen with that budget are two veterans of watching the legislature. Jack Betts is associate editor of the Charlotte Observer. Rob Christensen is a political columnist at the Raleigh News and Observer. And we welcome your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. We were talking just a moment ago about there was the proposal in the Senate budget to reduce the corporate tax rate in North Carolina from, I believe, 6.9% to 6.5%. And those couples who make more than $200,000 a year would see a reduction in their tax rates from 8.25% to 7.75%. The point of this all, Rob Christensen?
Well, Melinda, the one way to look at this is there was almost a whiff of fear in the Senate chambers last week, and that's because they are very they being the senators are very very worried about the economy, even though we've come out of the recession. They're looking at the three-legged stool of North Carolina: tobacco, textiles, and furniture, all hurting. Every day you pick up the newspaper or turn on the TV or the radio, you know, there's another plant closing, and they see no end to that. And so they're looking, they, the senators, are looking to do whatever they can to entice more business to come to North Carolina. You know, David Hoyle, who was the co-chairman of the Finance Committee, one of the architects of the tax bill, is from Gaston County. And Gaston County was the leading textile county, and textiles are disappearing. And so what they're turning to is, I guess you might call it the old trickle-down theory of that what we need to do is get more of those CEOs and make it more attractive for them to come by cutting their taxes, couples making $200,000 or more, cutting corporate taxes, even though the North Carolina is, by most measures, pretty attractive for business. There have been any number of studies that have come out and over the last number of years that look at North Carolina and compare it with other states and how attractive their tax system is to businesses. And every one of them shows North Carolina to be very attractive. But there really is a concern. And then I think there's another issue, too. And I think that is that, North Carolina has always been a very pro, the politicians have been very pro-business.
Democrat and Republican.
Democrat and mm-hmm. Republican, you know. And there's several reasons for that, in my view. But the main thing is that this state was a poor farming state in the beginning of the 20th century, and the state very much wanted to industrialize. And so all its policies, whether it's its tax policies, keeping taxes low or keeping spending restrained or sending in the National Guard to break strikes, all this, or keeping workers' comp low, all these were designed to industrialize a state and attract industry. And that was true 100 years ago, and that's true today. And that's particularly true in the North Carolina Senate. I'm not quite sure, Jack, why the North Carolina Senate has always been more business, pro-business, but it always has been as long as I've been covering it. It's been a big ally of business. So for all those reasons, it's not too surprising to see once again, the North Carolina politicians making it easier for big business and for the well-to-do in an effort to attract industry.
And it's pro-business because that policy that Rob just described to you in the 20th century worked. North Carolina became one of the most industrialized states in its manufacturing. Now, manufacturing has gone away, and business leaders want to do whatever they, or Senate leaders are trying to do whatever they can to maintain this image of the state as really receptive to business, despite the fact that North Carolina always shows up well in surveys of a good business atmosphere.
Is it the governor that you raised before, though, about how it compares to other southeastern
yes,
states?
Yes, and the governor has, for the last year at least, has been at pains to point out that while our rates are not wildly out of whack, that his concern was that when industrial prospects look at North Carolina and some other states, that those high top rates, the top marginal rates, might have been the one thing that made them pass over considering North Carolina. The theory goes that by dropping those rates down on the high personal income tax and the corporate rates, dropping those down a fraction of a point, that will get North Carolina another look and bring more industrial prospects into the state, where they will then vie for the various kinds of incentives that North Carolina offers mm-hmm. for industrial prospects.
Well, a half a percentage point on $200,000 a year, if my math correct, is that $1,000 that would be the difference?
I'm a journalist,
I didn't bring my calculator either.
So, you're asking the wrong people here.
Well, let me pose this other
question.
That
is a significant sum, and a lot of individual taxpayers are paying their business taxes through that. Mm-hmm.
But here's the question, because there's been this talk about attracting businesses to North Carolina, and of late there have been some rather large multi-million dollar tax breaks given to companies, Dell to set up in the Triad, mm-hmm. Black & Decker, which recently moved out of mm-hmm. of a place in Fayetteville. But they got these big tax breaks, tax incentives to come to North Carolina. So if we're going to cut across the board the corporate tax rate and going to cut the tax rate for the executives who work there, would we see an end to the incentive packages?
It would be nice to think so, but I don't think so. And here's why. I think cutting this rate is going to bring more prospects to North Carolina shopping for incentives and possibly create more competition for the incentives that that we give. So, every legislator you talk to prefaces this conversation by saying, I hate incentives, and I'd like not to have to give them. But we got to, because Alabama does and South Carolina does and Mississippi does and Virginia does. So nobody realistically is looking for that to go away.
Mm-hmm. It's the sort of the crack cocaine of economic development. I mean, all the states are addicted to it, and they're all afraid to go first to eliminate it, because they fear it would just provide such a disadvantage to that state.
And, of course, when these taxes are cut, there are also services that get cut, too. And social services were taking a hit or two.
Sure. In the Senate budget, something like 65,000 North Carolinians would go without Medicaid coverage. A number of them could yet other kinds of coverage, Medicare coverage, for example. But overall, it pushes thousands and thousands of people off those rolls to help pay for the $500 million in cuts and despite the $800 million in new revenues this budget is going to bring in.
And that's why this, and you talked earlier about what Jack's had to say about that budget, and that's why this of all the budgets I've seen over the years, this is about the biggest public relations fiasco I've ever seen.
Amen.
Because A, they're cutting taxes for the rich, and B, they're cutting the disabled off their health insurance. I mean, I don't think they sat down and figure out how this might look, personally.
Yeah.
We go to Tom, who's in Edenton. Hi there, Tom.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine.
Good. I'm the director of the First Judicial District Sentencing Services Program, and I want to give you an example of how the Senate has cut off its nose to spite its face. Our Sentencing Services Program, which is part of the Administrative Office of the Courts, has been cut from the state, from the Senate budget.
In other words, no money at all?
No money at all. Our budget is about $3.5 million a year. Last year, we saved the state over $23 million in diverting 70% of the clients that we serviced from prison. We do sentencing plans, which is involved in pretrial, and we do detailed background investigations, and then we come up with recommendations very specifically for rehabilitation of offenders that also protects society. Mental health, substance abuse, short and long-term residential options, these are all things that we do. Probation does not do this. We do it before the sentencing thing. Our plans statewide have resulted in a 72% decrease in recidivism, that is the number of offenders who will repeat their crimes. The judges last year followed 78% our recommendations 78% of the time on the over 1,800 plans that we presented.
So, Tom, how is it that you got cut from the Senate budget?
Well, because I think the Senate would rather build prisons and put people in prisons with no hope of rehabilitation than they would focus on community penalties and rehabilitation to get these citizens back on the right path and back in their communities as good tax-paying citizens.
But I wonder if this is still a work in progress. It has to go to the House now. What are you planning to do to try to persuade the state to keep this program going?
Well, that's one reason I'm on the radio, and we have a statewide lobbying effort right now to get our legislators to see the value of rehabilitation and community sentencing that is trying to help offenders who are nonviolent and who can be helped to come back in the community.
Well, Melinda, I'd like to have Jack Betts wants to add something here.
Melinda, what we are seeing here and what Tom is talking about really is a discouraging trend in the legislature to give each year lately a smaller portion of the state budget to the judicial branch of government. It's one of the three branches, but by far the smallest, and its share of the spending has dropped from around 3 just a few years ago to, Bev Lake computed the other day, a little less than 2.4%. And the only new items of spending in the Senate budget for the judicial branch is $1.5 million for a telephone system for the new courthouse in Mecklenburg County, and the creation of a couple of new, one or two new judicial districts. Not only would senators cut out the sentencing alternatives program that Tom was talking about, they would also cut out what has become a national model drug treatment court system in North Carolina in 9 judicial districts. There are something like 30 substance abuse and DWI courts that have shown a great deal of promise for
for getting substance abusers off dope and off alcohol and becoming productive citizens again. And they cut out $1 million for a program that was probably saving taxpayers, I don't know, variously estimated at $3 to $7 million a year. So that's just a trend that's not good for North Carolina. It's definitely not good for the court system.
Well, how is it that one comes to this point, Rob? Is this just part of the process that the Senate comes up with its proposal? It cuts these things out. There may be a hue and cry. People perhaps like Jack pointing out that these programs may have saved money. And then does it get back into the budget? Or
well, some of it gets back in the budget. Obviously, we're at the point now where the House will pass. The bill goes to the House, and the House passes its budget, and we'll have very sharply different views in all probability, even though they're both bodies are controlled by Democrats, and then you'll have the negotiations that go on. Our caller raised an interesting point, though, and that is it's more popular for the legislators to do things build like prisons, because prisons are something you could point to. They're concrete. They create jobs. Prisons have almost become a jobs program, putting them in rural areas where there's a high unemployment. So things like prisons are actually more attractive to a lot of lawmakers than are some of these preventive programs, because there's nothing you can point to in the preventive programs. They're just in offices somewhere where some people are trying to help people, and as opposed to prison.
We should point out that the Senate budget does actually call for more money than even the governor was talking for low-income school districts.
Well, it does for disadvantaged student supplemental funding program, which is a little bit different from the low-wealth fund. There are a couple of different pots of money. The governor actually proposes more than the Senate for the low-wealth fund. Okay. But the Senate proposes about $25 million more for the disadvantaged student supplemental fund. These are the schools, not just rural, not just small, not just low wealth, but also some of the urban school districts that have money but also have a lot of different kinds of costly social and educational problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's another aspect of the budget that has to do with education, and some are seeing this as the unraveling of the UNC system, and that there's a provision in the budget that calls for letting out-of-state students to the state universities in the UNC system who win scholarships to be counted as in-state. And in the end, how does that lead us to the dismantling of the UNC system?
Well, what it does is would allow foundations that give scholarships, like the Moorhead Foundation, the Park Foundation, to give a few more scholarships because they're not as costly. It also takes a load off the athletic departments, particularly, I think, at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University, because their athletic scholarships suddenly become cheaper for out-of-staters who are on full scholarship. The place where it's bad policy and where it undermines the notion of a central governing board for the 16-campus UNC system is that all these full scholarship out-of-staters counted as charged in-state tuition are not counted against the cap, the 18% cap at Chapel Hill, for example, on out-of-state residents in the freshman class. We don't know what the overall implication of that is, but there would be arguably more out-of-staters.
Right. Well, I understand that the Board of Governors at UNC didn't push for this, didn't know about it. The chancellors say they didn't either. So, Rob Christensen, who was behind this?
Well, obviously some supporters of some of the athletic organizations and so forth. And some supporters of the various campuses.
And the boards of trustees.
The board of trustees. The quick history lesson. Prior to 1971, I think it was 71, when they set up the UNC Board of Governors, there were 16 state university campuses, and they all were their own bosses, essentially. And so they all went and lobbied the legislature. And so it was who had the most powerful legislator living in their district. And so each legislator would try to prove that he had the clout and the muscle by getting money for his university. And it was a free-for-all and a fight. And it really, there was no rhyme or reason to where the money was going to in the university system. It was just all about political power. The idea, it was under Governor Bob Scott, was to put it all together under one central board and have the wise heads of the state, essentially the UNC Board of Governors, get together and put in priorities and say, listen, we have a limited amount of money. What makes sense for how much for this campus, how much for that campus? And let's stop all this infighting. But it's been, and the system has worked fairly well over the last couple decades. But there is this continuing tension and effort by legislators who don't want to just follow the lead of the UNC Board of Governors. They say, listen, I'm the charge here in the Senate, or I'm in charge of the House. What's the point of being in charge if I can't get some big appropriation for my campus? So what we're having is we're a weakening of a system that was designed in the early 70s to make some sense, to bring some logic and some order and some priority to the system. And we're seeing it break it apart as various campuses and various politicians say, hey, I want to get some for my campus.
Well, just before we go, I'm just curious what you think the chances are that there'll be radical changes to the Senate budget when it comes back from the State House.
Always changes. And I think there will be some significant ones when it comes back from the House.
Will it not be a ratty fabric anymore?
We'll see. It might be tattered in different ways.
Okay. And Rob, your prediction on it?
I think that we're going to look at a long, hot summer of negotiations between the House and the Senate, as because there are vast differences, and who knows what it'll look like.
Okay. Well, y'all come back and we'll talk about it again. Thanks so much for being with us. The Senate budget now goes to the State House. We'll keep watching. Jack Betts, Rob Christensen, thanks for being with us again.
Enjoyed it.
My pleasure.
Jack Betts is associate editor at the Charlotte Observer. Rob Christensen is political columnist at the Raleigh News and Observer. And just ahead on the state of things, the antagonistic relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr is seen through the eyes of a triangle author.